Since we started looking at God's chosen Old Testament people back in study four with the selection of Abraham, and then talked about the separation and the calling that they were called to be a separate, set-apart people for His holy destiny, and then we talked about the uniting factors that God put in place to help enable them and prepare them to be His people to fulfill the destiny to which He's called them. And then even last week, as we talked about the nation of Israel leaving Egypt, or the people of Israel leaving Egypt and becoming a nation, being prepared to come into the promised land to be able to fulfill the destiny. We've been talking in all of those lessons about God preparing His people for the destiny to which He's called them. And today we're going to start talking more about how God empowered His people so that they would be able to fulfill that destiny. And you see, our theme today deals with a destiny insured. So as we get into this, let me start first with a PKism, because I love this PKism today. It says, when someone tells you that they don't believe in God, well, ask them to describe the God that they don't believe in. Chances are you don't believe in that God either. I think that's just a great quote, a great comment there. Now, last week, we didn't talk so much about the destiny, but we kind of did. Okay, we looked at the Exodus event. We looked at the Israelites leaving Egypt and spending 40 years in the wilderness, in the desert, before they came into the Promised Land. And we saw that that 40 years and the experiences during that 40 years all had a key purpose. And that was to teach them to trust in the Lord. That was the purpose, to teach them to trust in the Lord. Why was that so important? Because if they were going to be able to fulfill their destiny of being blessed to be a blessing and being the channel through whom God was going to bless all peoples on earth, they had to put their trust in Him. That was so important. And we looked at the various experiences that God used to teach them to put their trust in the Lord. And we made this little diagram on the board, and it's on your handout from study 7, so you can look back at that as we go through this. We see that a lot of their experiences, you think of their experiences in the desert and you think of a lot of the crises they encountered. Their backs up against the Red Sea with the Egyptian army coming down on them. Going out in the desert and needing water and only finding bitter water. Or not having any food or not having any water at all. Other crises that popped up. Those were crises we looked at that just last week that just happened within the first 3 months of their experience in the desert. All of these experiences, they were crises. There was no way out. There was nothing that the Israelites could do to save themselves. They were doomed. They were lost on their own. But in each case, we see that God intervened. And He intervened for a purpose. He intervened not just to bless and save them, but more importantly, to teach them to put their trust in Him. They saw through these crises and trials that God is there, that God is their God, that God is looking out for them, and that they can trust in Him and He will take care of them. One of our concepts that we had, the memory concepts in the last half of Exodus, in fact, all the memory concepts in the last half of Exodus fit into our study last week. And the one that says God, a constant presence in Israel's midst, fit within this theme of crises and trials. And where do we find that? Exodus 40. Okay, we also then saw that organization was put into place, that this people, Israel, was nothing really more than a people. They were not a nation, and yet they were called to become a nation. They were a group of slaves, so they had no leadership, no organization, and God put organization in place. Okay? You see, that started with God working through Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, to direct Moses to set up a chain of leadership. And we had leaders of tens and fifties and hundreds and thousands. And you have that where? Exodus 18. It's one of our memory concepts. And we had the story of in Numbers, they took a census, took a head count, and then put leaders over the tribes and over the people and divided up the duties among the Levites. There were instructions on how to make camp and break camp and how to know when to make camp or break camp with a communication system with trumpets. And we talked about all of those, and those were all organizational things that people would look to their leaders and follow their leaders. These are leaders that God put into place, and we'll talk a little bit about that a little bit more today. People that God had equipped and prepared for the task, which that's another one of our concepts. God equips people for specific tasks was Exodus 31. We also saw that besides organization, they needed laws. The only laws that these people knew were the laws of the Egyptians. That's where they'd been for 430 years. They knew those laws, but those were not God's laws. That was not how to be God's people. And so God gave them the laws that they needed to get started. He gave them some civil laws to kick them off. Okay, we saw that this was a group of nomads, right? For at least for 40 years, they would be wandering around in the wilderness. There were special laws that they needed just to be able to deal with each other for those 40 years. And those civil laws for nomads we found where? It's a memory concept. Exodus 21 to 23. And not only those, not only the civil laws for nomads, but just civil laws in general. This is a new nation, a nation that needed to get started with civil laws. And you have like the eye for an eye code. Where's that? Exodus 21. These were civil laws, okay? And we said that civil laws can change over time. They will change over time. They evolve. Like I mentioned, we have a legislature that exists for the sole purpose of changing laws, of evolving laws, of coming up with new ones, destroying old ones, modifying old ones, whatever. There, we also saw that God gave them a batch of ceremonial laws, okay? Ceremonial laws that deal with how we interface with God. And we saw that that evolves over time. Okay, the way that we worship God today is different than the way that God was worshiped back then. Not because God has changed. No, God has stayed constant, but we have changed. And our lives change, and so how we interact with God changes over time as well. Some of the ceremonial laws that were put into place for the Israelites back then were actually foreshadowing what God was going to do through His Son, Jesus Christ. And that Jesus fulfilled those things. In fact, we're going to talk a lot about that next week. You see, a lot of the laws, the ceremonial laws, dealt with sacrifice for atonement. And we'll talk about atonement next week. And Jesus fulfilled all of that. He's the great atonement, once and for all, that we no longer need to sacrifice goats and lambs and whatever. So we have the instructions to build a tabernacle that falls under these ceremonial laws. Okay, and we'll talk about tabernacle today. And that was found in Exodus chapter 25 through 27. Okay, 25 through 27. And we also saw the inauguration of the priesthood. That was Exodus 28 and 29. Okay, 28 and 29. The other law type that God instituted were the moral laws. And we saw the moral laws are things that do not change because God's moral standards 3,000 years ago are the same as He has today, as the same when He first created the earth. Those standards are standards that kind of the key ones we look at are the ones in the Ten Commandments. The commands that Jesus summed up by saying the greatest commandment is loving the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And the second is love your neighbor as yourself. You know, if you take care of those two things, then you've taken care of God's moral law. We talked about how God demands and insists on pure worship and pure justice. He doesn't want to be one God of many. He is our only God. Any worship that involves anything other than just purely worshiping Him is not pure worship, and He commands against that. Likewise, He insists on pure justice to one another. And anything short of pure justice is against His will. And as we love our neighbor as ourselves, that results in pure justice because we want pure justice done to us, right? So, the Ten Commandments, where do we find that? Exodus 20. Now, why were these laws critical? Why was it important that God give them some laws? Well, because they had no laws. This was just a group of people. The only laws they knew were the Egyptian laws, and these people weren't lawyers anyway. They were slaves. They weren't educated, so they had nothing really to guide them. And the Egyptian laws that they did know were not God's laws, were not the laws for them. They were not Egyptians. They were God's people. And then we also talked about how God used rigid discipline. Rigid discipline. Because as someone would go against his commands, if God allowed that, especially during these infancy formative years of Israel, then that could and would pollute and destroy what God was trying to build here as his nation. And so when people stepped away from God's intent and God's commands, he responded quickly and strongly with rigid discipline. We saw an example of idolatry with a golden calf. You saw how God responded with executions and with plagues. You had the religious abuse of Aaron's sons lighting unauthorized fire to the Lord. It doesn't sound like a big thing to us, but God's response of striking them down with this rigid discipline resulted in a very strong respect on the part of the priests for the commands that God had given them, these ceremonial commands, to keep them pure, the pure worship that God insisted on. Blasphemy, someone cursing God. You saw that he was stoned by the assembly. Made sure people didn't curse God again, right? The jealousy of Miriam and Aaron, and then also the mutiny that popped up with the Korah rebellion, and how God responded with rigid discipline to both of those. Okay, some of our concepts, the golden calf we find in Exodus 32. And visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, Exodus 34. So again, what we've seen, and if you want to look at the chart that we just on the page 4 of your handout of last week's lesson, is all of the events and experiences during Israel's time in the wilderness were there to teach them to trust in the Lord. The crises and trials that they went through and God's response to that taught them to trust in the Lord. The organization that was put into place, looking to their leaders who then looked to God, and God was their ultimate leader, that taught them to put their trust in the Lord. The laws and legislation that God gave them on Mount Sinai, what other nation has laws like ours? Those taught them to put their trust in the Lord. And the rigid discipline that God responded with when people broke those laws taught them to trust in the Lord. And that's the purpose of all the stories that we have. That's the cargo of the Exodus experience. Okay? Now, going on, let's talk a little bit more because we are still looking at the destiny. Okay? These things that happened in the wilderness experiences were there to enable and empower them to fulfill their destiny by trusting in God. Now, there's still more. They've been prepared for this destiny, and now it's time for God to take the next steps to make sure that they can fulfill their destiny. And what is that destiny again? It'll go way back to the very beginning when it was first called to Abraham. Genesis 12, 2-3. God told Abraham, he said, I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I'll make your name great and you will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all people on earth will be blessed through you. So they were blessed to be a blessing so that through them all people on earth can be blessed. Now, were these enough? The selection, the separation, and the unity that we discussed in studies 4, 5, and 6, were they enough to ensure that Israel's destiny would be fulfilled? I'll turn to Numbers chapter 14, verse 11. And this is God speaking to Moses, and he says, how long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me, in spite of all the miraculous signs that I have performed among them? So even though God continued to reveal himself and his power to these people during their wilderness experiences, they continued to fall short of putting their faith in him, putting their trust in him. So the problem with that is that put the whole destiny at risk. Unless they could put their trust in God, unless they would put their trust in the Lord, they could not fulfill the destiny that God had for them. And so they had 40 years of training. Okay, 40 years of training. And the Numbers verse that we read was early on. Now, later on, as they got closer after that 40 years, towards the end of that 40 years, as the time neared for them to go into the Promised Land and take the Promised Land, Moses re-talked to all the people. Now we're dealing with the new generation. Okay, that first generation had died off, and now we're dealing with those who had been 20 years old or under, or hadn't even been born yet, back at the beginning of the Exodus. And he reminded them of all the things that God had done for them and how God had prepared them. And that's what the book of Deuteronomy is. Deuteronomy, the word means second law. And it's basically the book where Moses is talking to that final generation, the wilderness generation, the generation that grew up in the wilderness, seeing these signs of God and reminding them of their destiny. The destiny that God has called them to. The destiny that has been in place for hundreds of years since God first spoke to Abraham. So, let's take a look at our picture. And you see our picture here with this anchor and this manuscript tied to the anchor. It says, I will bless you so that you will be a blessing. And there's that prism. Okay? There's that prism. So, the point of the manuscript and the message here is that even now, after Egypt, all these years later, the destiny still stands. Deuteronomy 7, verses 12 to 15. Moses says, if you pay attention to these laws and you're careful to follow them, then the Lord your God will keep His covenant of love with you as He swore to your forefathers. He will love you and bless you and increase your numbers. He'll bless the fruit of your womb, the crops of your land, your grain, new wine and oil, the calves of your herds and the lambs of your flock in the land that He swore to your forefathers to give to you. You'll be more blessed than any of the other people. None of your men or women will be childless, nor any of your livestock without young. The Lord will keep you free from every disease. He'll not inflict on you the horrible diseases you knew in Egypt, but He'll inflict them on all those who hate you. So look at what Moses is saying here. He says, if you obey the Lord, if you follow the commands and laws that God has given to you, if you do your part of God's covenant, then God will fulfill His covenant to you. He will bless you so that you can be a blessing. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 9 and 10. It says, the Lord will establish you as His holy people, as He promised you on oath, if you keep the commands of the Lord your God and walk in His ways. And then all the people on earth will see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they will fear you. So all people on earth will see that you are His people if you remain within His covenant. So that covenant calling of being blessed to be a blessing still stands. Okay? It's still there. That destiny is still there even after Egypt. Now that destiny we see is tied to this anchor. That reminds us that this destiny needed to be ensured. We've seen in those verses we just read that that destiny was contingent on what? On their obedience. That sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? Remember God's divine intentions back in study 2 was contingent on what? Obedience, obeying God, walking in a right relationship with Him. And so this covenant was contingent upon obedience. And how well do we do at that? We've screwed that up over and over again. Okay, you look at study 3, the disharmony. So God put ensuring factors in place to help ensure that the destiny would be fulfilled. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 15 to 18. See, Moses says, giving God's word, see, I set before you today life and prosperity, or death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in His ways, and to keep His commands, decrees, and laws. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you're entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you're not obedient, and if you're drawn away to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day that you will certainly be destroyed. You will not live long in the land that you're crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. So that's what they were faced with. This is chapter 30 of Deuteronomy. So towards the end here of his talk with this wilderness generation, he's saying, okay, here's the deal. Okay, I've told you this. You need to follow God's commands. You need to obey Him to fulfill this destiny. And so today I'm giving you the choice. Either life and prosperity or death and destruction. You follow God and obey Him and He will bless you and you will fulfill you'll be able to fulfill the destiny of being blessed to be a blessing. But if you disobey God, if you reject God and turn to other gods, well then He'll destroy you. Being called for this destiny doesn't mean that you're protected against rejecting Him. Okay? So the destiny needed to be ensured because it was contingent upon obedience. And then we see this anchor, what's it lodged in? It's lodged in sand. Because we are independable. We have not proven ourselves well to obey God. And at the infancy stage of this people of Israel, this nation of Israel, they really needed help to ensure this destiny. So ensuring factors were critical at this infancy stage. Deuteronomy 7 verses 6 to 11. Moses says, "For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all people on the face of the earth to be His people, His treasured possession. The Lord didn't set His affection on you and choose you because you're more numerous than other people. You're the fewest of all people. But it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath that He swore to His forefathers that He brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He's the faithful God, keeping His covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love Him and keep His commands. But those who hate Him, He'll repay to their face by destruction. He will not be slow to repay to their face those who hate Him. Therefore, take care to follow these commands, decrees, and laws that I give you today." So Moses tells him, you were chosen by God purely out of His love and grace. So follow Him, stay with Him, and He will bless you. Okay? You're just now starting out. You're the baby Israel here. God's got plans for you as long as you stay with Him. Put your trust in Him. So what were some of these ensuring factors? Well, we see these on the rocks down at the bottom here. We'll start out with the lightning strikes. Okay? The lightning strikes. And we'll also look at your homework. Okay? So look at your homework. And question number one on your homework said, do miraculous elements have any direct relationship to Israel's needs in this period of its history? Well, look at Exodus chapter 4, verses 1 through 8. Moses answered, "What if they don't believe me or listen to me and say, 'The Lord didn't appear to you'?" Well, then the Lord said to him, "What's that in your hand?" Staff, he replied. The Lord said, "Throw it on the ground." Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a snake, and he ran away from it. Then the Lord said to him, "Okay, reach out your hand and take it by the tail." So Moses reached out, took a hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. "This," said the Lord, "is so that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you." Well, then the Lord said, "Now put your hand inside your cloak." So Moses put his hand into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was leprous, like snow. "Now, put it back into your cloak," he said. So Moses put his hand back into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was restored, like the rest of his flesh. Then the Lord said, if they don't believe you or pay attention to the first miraculous sign, they may believe the second. But if they don't believe these two signs or listen to you, well, then take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. The water you take from the river will become like blood on the ground. So what do we have here? We have some miraculous signs that God gave Moses. For what purpose? So that they would believe that he was called and sent by God. Moses was going to appear to these people out of the blue. They didn't know him from Adam. Some of them might remember that 40 years before, he was this stepson of Pharaoh that ran away after killing an Egyptian. But chances are maybe they didn't remember. But maybe they did. But nonetheless, what would make them think that he was sent by God? So God gave these to Moses, these miraculous signs, so that he could show, for what purpose? To build trust and faith in the Jewish leaders, in the Israelite leaders, in Moses as being God's chosen, God's called servant. So that's what we see. It's kind of like what we saw last week, that the interventions, the divine interventions that God made in the Israelites' history were there for what purpose? To teach them to put their trust in the Lord. Okay? When he intervened in crises or trials, intervened with organization or the law or rigid discipline, they were all there to teach them to trust in the Lord. And so that's what these lightning strikes on the rock here show us, are divine intervention. So God divinely intervened to teach Israel to trust in him. Okay? That is one of the ensuring factors. Now let's look at another one. Joshua chapter 3. Joshua chapter 3, verses 7 to 10. And the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all of Israel, so that they may know that I am with you, just as I was with Moses. So tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river. So Joshua said to the Israelites, come here and listen to this, to the words of the Lord your God. This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and that he will certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. Now, the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest. Yet, as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan while all of Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. So here we see a miracle, a divine intervention very similar to what God did through Moses early on, and that was the crossing of the Red Sea. And now we have the crossing of the Jordan River on dry ground. And just the moment that the priests started to put their feet in the water dried up. Okay? What was the purpose of this? In each case, in the case with Moses, and now in the case here with Joshua, it was to teach the people to put their trust and confidence in Joshua, okay, as being Joshua chosen from God. That's what God said he was going to do to, for Joshua right there at the beginning. So, a quote from Pastor Kay here is that miracles appeared in the early period to develop trust, much like the early conversion period in the life of a new Christian. Have you ever noticed in a new Christian all the ways that they see God at work and the things that they will comment on? And, you know, maybe God's a little bit more active in their lives to help them just as he was in the early infancy stage of Israel, to teach them that he's there, to teach them to put their trust and confidence in him. So when does God use direct divine intervention? When does God get in the middle of things? Well, let's look at a few examples. Okay, Genesis chapter 2. Okay, way back in the beginning. Chapter 2, verses 21 to 22. We see the Lord God caused the man to fall into a deep sleep. And while he was sleeping, he took one of the man's ribs and closed up the place with flesh. Then the Lord God made a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. Well, that's divine intervention there, right? God got involved with this by personally going and creating a woman out of man. Okay, so that was kind of an important part of his plan, wasn't it? So it was an important thing for him to do in his plan. Let's look at another one. Genesis chapter 9, verses 12 to 13. God said, "This is the sign of the covenant that I'm making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I've set my rainbow in the clouds, and it'll be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth." So what is it? The rainbow. And every time a rainbow is formed is a reminder to us of God's promise to us. And he's given us that as a sign of the covenant. So there's a divine intervention. Okay? Genesis 12, 1 to 3. Well, you ought to be able to recite this now. "The Lord said to Abram, 'Leave your country, your people, your father's household, and go to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you.'" That is definitely the selection of Abram and his descendants, the calling, the separation of them, the unifying of them, the work that he's done to bless them, to be a blessing, and blessing all people on earth through them is all divine intervention. Why was that important? Because it's part of his plan. Exodus 14, 21 to 22. "Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left." Israel crossing the Red Sea on dry ground. An important part of God's plan to get the Israelites out of Egypt and moving on, but also to show them that he's there in control and to teach them to put their trust in him. We'll look at one more. There's obviously gazillions of them. But John chapter 2, verse 11. "This is the first of his miraculous signs that Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him." So when does God use direct divine intervention? Whenever his plan calls for it. Okay, when his plan calls for it. And most commonly, the reason is to build trust. Anytime we see Jesus performing a miracle, it always has the purpose of building faith, building trust. Okay? Now, does God use direct divine intervention every day? Well, you know, some people say yes, some people say, I don't know, you know. Well, do we see these great miracles of crossing the Red Sea or water turning to wine or those kind of things on a regular basis? Not really. So why not? Luke 16, verses 27 to 31. Jesus is telling this parable here, and in the parable it says, "He answered, 'Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to the place of torment.' Abram replied, 'They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them.' 'No, Father Abraham,' he said, 'but if someone from the dead goes to them, they'll repent.' He said to him, 'If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead.'" Now, whenever you see Moses and the prophets, when it says if they have Moses and the prophets, that's what they used to call the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament, okay, the Scriptures back in Jesus' day. And Jesus says, God's already revealed himself to us. Listen to his word. You'll see the signs of his divine intervention through the words, okay? The word is there to build trust. So should we expect God to reveal himself to us through divine intervention? Look at Mark chapter 8. Verse 11 and 12. "The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, 'Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it.' So will all generations, will all people receive signs? No, Jesus said that generation wouldn't receive signs. Not all generations will receive signs. God gives signs when he sees the need, when he has the need. It's not when we ask for it or any of that, when he, it suits his purposes. Okay? Another PKism. People who refuse to believe were never able to see. And if you look at that, with the miracles that Jesus performed, those who rejected him didn't accept the miracles. They couldn't understand his parables. But those who did have faith, they saw God at work in everything. So which camp do you fall in? Do you have trouble seeing the miracles and understanding God's word? Or do you have faith and you see the work of God in everything? So, what does that mean for us? Should we be concerned with how or why miracles happen? Yep, this is that old think Hebrew thing, okay? As Greek Western mindset people, we like to know how it happened. But that's not what's important. What's important is why. What is God trying to teach us through this? What does God want us to learn through this? The how is the vehicle, the why is the cargo. Okay, and where to look for the why. So again, in these ensuring factors, this lightning strikes on the rock reminds us that God used divine intervention to develop confidence and trust in this early nation of Israel. All right? Next, we'll look at the next one here, this little scales there. Okay, the scales of justice here. Okay? This talks about the civil and moral law that God gave that prevented chaos and destruction. Okay? This is a new nation. Now, your question number two on your homework. Could Israel have existed in its nomad days without the types of laws that we have in Exodus chapter 21 through 23? And what was Exodus 21 through 23? Remember your memory concept? Civil laws for nomads. Could they have existed without that? Well, let's take a look at a little story from before those civil laws were instituted or given by God. Back in Exodus chapter 18, okay, your memory concept will remind you what this is about. This is about Jethro giving Moses advice on delegating authority and responsibility. So verse 13 says, the next day Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning until evening. When his father-in-law saw that all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this that you're doing for the people? Why do you sit as judge while all these people stand around you from morning till evening?" Let's go to 17. Moses' father-in-law said, "What you're doing is not good. You and these people who come out to you will only wear yourselves out. The work's too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. So listen now to me, and I'll give you some advice. And may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to Him. So teach them the decrees and laws and show them the way to live and the duties that they're to perform. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but then have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. That'll make your load lighter because they'll share it with you." So what do we have here? We have Moses trying to do it all himself. And if Moses had kept doing that, the nation could not have turned in, the people could not have turned into a nation. But instead, he needed to give them laws and decrees and commands to follow. But they weren't things that he could come up with, so God gave them to him. But what he also did is put in this organization so that this was important for them to be able to exist and have leaders so that they could exist as a nation. Another one, Exodus chapter 32, verses 7 to 9. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, because your people," and this is while he's up on Mount Sinai, and the people were building the golden calf. He says, "Go down, because your people, whom you brought out of Egypt, have become corrupt. They've been quick to turn away from what I commanded them. and they've made themselves an idol, cast in the shape of a calf. They bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and have said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." "I've seen these people," the Lord said to Moses, "and they are a stiff-necked people." So we see that before they received all the laws, they very quickly turned away from God. Okay? And built this golden calf and started trying to worship this other god that they made up. So could Israel have existed in its nomad days without the type of laws that you have here that God gave them on Mount Sinai? It was mighty tough. They were not a people that looked like they could do that on their own. So why were these laws critical for ensuring the destiny? Exodus 19, verses 3 to 6. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you're to say to the house of Jacob and what you're to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." So these are the words that you're to speak to the Israelites. So why were laws critical for this, for ensuring the destiny? Because they needed to obey him so that they could fulfill the destiny, so that they could be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, set apart by God for this destiny. That destiny, as we mentioned before, was contingent upon obedience. So they needed the laws to know what God's will was, what God's instructions were, what God's commands were in order to obey them. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 5 through 8. "See, I've taught you decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded me, so that you may follow them in the land that you're entering to take possession of it. Observe them carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations who will hear about these decrees and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. What other nation is so great as to have their gods near them the way the Lord our God is near us whenever we pray to him? And what other nation is so great as to have such righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws that I'm setting before you today?'" So Israel would be respected for such great righteous laws. Laws that cannot be conceived by people, but rather came from God. And other peoples will see them and be blessed by them. Blessed by those laws that Israel has. Take a look at the laws of America, and so many of them have foundations in the laws of Israel. In order to ensure the destiny, the civil laws, the moral laws that God instituted helped prevent chaos and destruction of this baby nation and help them come together as a people and as a nation to stay together to help ensure the destiny. Okay? Alright, next. The next one is the separated figures here. Okay? And what does that deal with? It deals with separation. Okay? And what we have here is they had separation. We talked about how circumcision was a constant reminder to them of being a separate, cut-off people. But there were other things that God put into place that helped provide visual reminders of their call to be separate. Look at your question number 3. Question number 3 is, what purpose might the Nazarites have accomplished in Israel's camp? All right, what's the Nazarite? What is a Nazarite? Go to Numbers chapter 6. Numbers chapter 6 tells all about the Nazarite. And we'll just read the first few verses here. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man or a woman wants to make a special vow, a vow of separation to the Lord as a Nazarite, then he must abstain from wine and other fermented drink, and must not drink vinegar made from wine or from other fermented drink. He must not drink grape juice or eat grapes or even raisins. As long as he's a Nazarite, he must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine, not even seed or skins. During the entire period of his vow of separation, no razor may be used on his head. He must be holy until the period of his separation to the Lord is over. He must let the hair of his head grow long." So what do you think? the Nazirite was there, and someone who would take the vow of the Nazirite, saying that I'm going to dedicate myself to the Lord for this period of time. We've got a few stories of some that were Nazirites for life, but most commonly people would take this vow of the Nazirite and go through a period of time where they were dedicated to God. And during that time, they were to abstain from certain things, okay, no drinking alcohol, no eating anything with grapes, and you know, that was the flavor that they used. That's, grapes were kind of a key thing. If you didn't drink water or milk, you could have grape juice or wine mixed with water to give you some flavor. They even used it to sweeten things. They would boil it down, and you had what they called grape honey, which is what they use as a sweetener, just boiled down grape juice. Those kind of things they couldn't touch. So if someone was a Nazirite and you had dinner with them, they wouldn't have any of those kind of things, even though everybody else would be. The Nazirite also couldn't cut their hair, couldn't shave their beard. And so when the thing about a Nazirite is, if someone was a Nazirite, you would notice it. They looked different. So what was the purpose of that in Israel's camp? They were walking reminders of Israel's call to be separate. Okay? They were a separated people within a separated people, and therefore provided a visual reminder of Israel's call to be separate. All right? Now the next part, question 4A, okay? It talked about the tassels. What purpose did the tassels in Numbers 15 accomplish for Israel? Well, let's look at, see what it said. Numbers 15, verses 37 to 41. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, throughout the generations to come, you're to make tassels on the corners of your garments with a blue cord on each tassel. You'll have these tassels to look at so that you'll remember all of the commands of the Lord, so that you may obey them and not prostitute yourself by going after the lusts of your own hearts and eyes. And then you'll remember to obey all my commands and be consecrated to your God. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God." So what's the deal with these tassels? Everyone was to wear these tassels. They were to tie them on the corners of their robes, on the corners of their clothes. So what's the deal? Well, if you think about it, as you'd walk along, those tassels down on your legs would bump up against your legs with every step. They'd hit you. You would feel them. You would be reminded with every step of these tassels. And what do the tassels remind you of? What God said here is, you will remember all the commands of the Lord so that you can obey them and not follow other gods. Not only would you feel the tassels, but the tassels had a blue cord, and everybody, you would see it. That blue cord would stand out. And so you'd look around a group of people, and what would stand out? All these tassels with the blue cords. So you would see these regular reminders that we are God's people. He is our God, and we're to obey His commands. Another example we see in Deuteronomy chapter 6. This is called the Great Shema. Okay, the first word in this, in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, is what? Hear. Hear, O Israel. Well, in Hebrew, the word hear is Shema. Okay, and that's why this is called the Great Shema. And this was some of the first words that a Jewish boy would memorize. And listen to this, verses 4 through 9. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give to you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your house and on your gates. Here's more reminders. Okay, you've got further reminders here saying, talk about it all the time. When you wake up, when you go to bed, when you stand up, when you're walking, when you're talking, talk about these things. Teach them to your kids. Write it on your hands. Okay, put it on your forehead. Put it on the door frames of your house so that you see it every time you come home. So this is all getting into the same thing. And what are we seeing here? These separated figures here is talking about visual aids. Okay, there were visual aids that God put in place to continually always remind them of their call to be separate, of their call to be a separated, holy, set-apart people for Him in an obedience-based, loving, righteous relationship with God. So visual aids perpetuated the ideas of separation and obedience is what that concept there is. All right, next, let's go over to the one with the chalice of wine and the bread. What does that remind you of? It reminds you of the Lord's Supper, right? To an Israelite, it would remind them of Passover, okay? Or one of the other feasts, okay? So, second part of question four, what purpose did the memorial feast accomplish for Israel? Well, let's look at some of those memorial feasts. Exodus chapter 12, verses 24 to 27, this is talking about the Passover. God tells Moses, obey these instructions as a lasting ordinance for you and your descendants. When you enter the land that the Lord will give you as He promised, observe this ceremony. And when your children ask you, what does this ceremony mean to you? Then tell them, it's the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when He struck down the Egyptians. And then the people bowed down and worshiped. So the Passover festival would remind them of how God saved them. Saved them from Egypt, saved them from slavery, saved them from all the plagues that He passed down on the Israelites, saved them from the plague of the firstborn sons. Okay, so the Passover festival, they would do that every year, and that would remind them of how God protected them and God took care of them. Exodus 13, verses 6 to 10. For 7 days, eat bread made without yeast, and on the seventh day, hold a festival to the Lord. Eat unleavened bread during those 7 days. Nothing with yeast in it is to be seen among you, nor shall any yeast be seen anywhere within your borders. On that day, tell your son, I do this because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. This observance will be for you like a sign on your hand, and a reminder on your forehead that the law of the Lord is to be on your lips. For the Lord brought you out of Egypt with His mighty hand. You must keep this ordinance at the appointed time, year after year. So here we have the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And there it says, this is to be a reminder that the law of the Lord is to be on your lips. It's kind of like writing something on your hands or on your forehead. It's always there as a reminder for you. Okay, let's look at one more. Leviticus 23. This is the Feast of Booths. 23 verses 41 to 43. Celebrate this as a festival to the Lord for 7 days each year. This is to be a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. Celebrate it in the seventh month. Live in booths for 7 days. All native-born Israelites are to live in booths, so that your descendants will know that I had the Israelites live in booths when I brought them out of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Okay? So, living in booths or tabernacles or tents. Okay? They lived in tents for a week to remind them of how Israel had lived in tents during their Exodus experience. During that 40 years and all the interactions they had with God. It was a reminder. So they had these memorial feasts on a regular basis, every year, and that was there to remind them of their past, but also of their present, that God is here among us now, continues to work among us now, and their future, their destiny. God's got a plan for us in the future as well. So the memorial feast served as an ensuring factor for the destiny, continued to remind them of their past, present, and future. Alright, the next one, we see a tent. Okay, we're just talking about tents. Let's look at the one on the tent. This is your question number five. What did the tabernacle and the tent of tabernacle mean to the Hebrews? Okay, well, it first helps to know what tabernacle means. Tabernacle just means dwelling place. Okay, so the tent of tabernacle was the tent of the dwelling place. Alright, what does that mean? What's all that about? Well, let's look at the tent of tabernacle here, where God commanded it. Exodus chapter 25, and we'll just look at verses 8 and verse 22. Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. Okay, that's verse 8, and then verse 22. There above the cover between the two cherubim and over the Ark of the Testimony, I will meet with you and give you all my commands for the Israelites. So, and you can read the verses in between there that talk a little bit about the Ark and the Tent of Tabernacle, and actually chapter 26 and forward talks about this tabernacle. And what did it say there it was for? It was his dwelling place. He would dwell there with them. He would dwell among them in their midst. Okay, this tabernacle would be in the middle. If you look back at how the camps would be settled back in the book of Numbers that we looked at last week, the tabernacle was in the middle, and so God was in the middle of them. He lived with them. It was his dwelling place. That's what tabernacle means. Exodus 40, verses 36 to 38. This is at the very end of the book of Exodus. And all the travels of the Israelites, whenever the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle, they would set out. But if the cloud didn't lift, they did not set out until the day it lifted. So the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, and in the sight of all the house of Israel during all their travels. So they would always, they could look to the tabernacle at any time and see the cloud that represented God's presence. God was there among them. God was present. He said, I'm going to be there. I will dwell there. I will be there with you. How does he tabernacle with us today? Well, John 1 verse 14, you can maybe recite this. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Okay? So, the word, the Greek word that's translated as dwelt is actually the word tabernacle. Okay? So the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. And God tabernacles with us. Okay, so the tent here reminds us that the tabernacle was a constant reminder of God's presence in their midst. Okay, and whether it be the tabernacle, that also is referred to as the tent of meeting. Okay, the ark was also a symbol of God's presence. And then later, the temple. Okay, a constant reminder of God's presence. That doesn't mean that God was constrained to the tent of tabernacle or to the temple. But it was a reminder of his presence. In fact, when the temple was built, Solomon said, you're not a God that can be contained in anything made by humans. But when we look to this temple, may we think of you. May we be reminded that you are present with us wherever we go. So the tabernacle was a constant reminder of God's presence in their midst. All right, the next thing, we see this staff, or the mace. Okay, it's called a mace. That deals with leadership, right? Leaders would hold maces or whatever. So, why was great leadership critical for ensuring the destiny? Turn to Numbers 16. This is a story that we referred to last week. Numbers 16, we'll do verse 3 and then 8 through 11. They came as a group, they being Korah and a few other folks, came as a group to oppose Moses and Aaron and said to them, you've gone too far. The whole community is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is with them. Why then do you set yourselves above the Lord's assembly? And then 8 to 11, Moses also said to Korah, now listen, you Levites, isn't it enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the Israelite community and brought you near himself to do the work at the Lord's tabernacle and to stand before the community and minister to them? He's brought you and all your fellow Levites near himself. But now you're trying to get the priesthood too. It's against the Lord that you and all your followers have banded together. Who is Aaron that you should grumble against him? So here we see this coup attempt by Korah and the others who tried to take over and sin against God. Why was great leadership critical for ensuring the destiny? Because who knows where it could lead. Korah and these other men were doing it for their sakes. They weren't doing it because God was calling them to be leaders. They wanted to be leaders. They didn't like God leading. They wanted to be the leaders. How would that ensure the destiny? That would destroy the destiny. What made great leadership? What was a key component for great leadership? Numbers 12, 5 to 8. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud. He stood at the entrance to the tent and summoned Aaron and Miriam. When both of them stepped forward, he said, listen to my words. When a prophet of the Lord is among you, I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams. But this is not true of my servant Moses. He's faithful in all my house. With him, I speak face to face, clearly and not in riddles. He sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? The anger of the Lord burned against them and he left them. What was it that made Moses stand out? He says, he is faithful in all my house. That's what God looks for in a leader. That's where we see all the great leaders in the Bible. How do they stand out? By their faith. Okay? So, God looked for leaders, and that's what the mace reminds us, is the leadership that God put in place were the leaders that had the proper credentials. And what are those proper credentials? A relationship with God, a right relationship with God, a strong faith. Let's look at some examples of some of the great leaders. Exodus chapter 4, verses 10 to 11. This is when God is calling Moses to go and get his people out of Egypt. Moses says to the Lord, Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue. The Lord said to him, who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go. I will help you speak, and I will teach you what to say. So, how did Moses get to be such a great spokesperson and a good representative of God? God made him that way. God told him the word, gave him the words to say. Okay? Joshua chapter 4, verse 14. That day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they revered him all the days of his life, just as they had revered Moses. So the great leader Joshua that took over from Moses became a great leader because God worked through him. God made him great in the eyes of the people. Judges chapter 6, verses 14 to 16. The Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? But Lord, Gideon asked, how can I save Israel? My clan's the weakest in Manasseh and I'm the least in my family. The Lord answered, I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together. God told Gideon, I will be with you, and I'll conquer them through you. Okay? I'll give you success because I am there. What made Gideon a great leader? You see, he was a reluctant leader just like Moses was. But God said, I will be there. I will work through you. I will make you the leader. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 8 and 9 and 16. Now then, tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from the pasture and from following the flock to be ruler over my people Israel. I've been with you wherever you've gone, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. Now I will make your name great, like the names of the greatest men on earth. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. David, the great King David, the Jews look back today as him being the greatest king they ever had, the greatest leader they ever had. And what made him great? He was just a nobody shepherd kid. And God made him great. God made his name great. God, he gave him victories. God established his kingdom. God raised David up. Okay? Jeremiah chapter 1, verses 6 to 8. In fact, I'll start at verse 4. The word of the Lord came to me saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. Oh, sovereign Lord, I said, I don't know how to speak. I'm only a child. But the Lord said to me, don't say I'm only a child. You must go to everywhere, everyone I send you to, and say whatever I command you to say. And don't be afraid of them, because I'm with you, and I will rescue you, declares the Lord. So Jeremiah, who he himself said that he was not up to the job, he was too young, too immature, God said, don't you think that it's you doing it. I will be with you. I will work through you. So, what's the common element that makes Israel's leaders great? That makes God's leaders great? God made them great. God working through them. God called them. Okay, has God called you to be a leader? If so, have you been doing the leading, or have you been letting God lead through you? God prepares us for leadership. God prepares us, His leaders, for leadership. A couple of examples we've talked about before. Exodus 2, just a couple quick summary verses here. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. So here we see that Moses grew up in Pharaoh's house until he was 40 years old. He spent 40 years learning how to lead the greatest nation in the world at the time, Egypt. And then, verse 15, says, when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. And you know the story then. He got in contact with the priest of Midian, lived with him and his family for 40 years, and learned what it meant to lead God's people, learned what it meant to have a relationship with God. So God used the 40 years in Pharaoh's house and the 40 years in Jethro's house to prepare Moses for what he was really destined to do. It didn't start until he was 80 years old. Okay? And that is leading God's people into becoming a nation out of the land of Egypt into the promised land. Another one, Exodus chapter 33, verse 11. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks with his friend. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent. So you see that young Joshua became an aide, an assistant to Moses, and helped Moses for many years. And when Moses spoke with God, Joshua was there. So through that, God prepared Joshua for the great leadership that he had in store for Joshua to do. So again, the mace here reminds us that leaders were provided who had the proper credentials of a right, faithful relationship with God. And that helped ensure the destiny. Alright, the last one here, the land scene. Okay, the land scene. Well, what are we talking about, the land? We're talking about the promised land. Question number 6. What is meant by the story in Joshua chapter 5, verses 13 to 15? Well, let's read that story and remind ourselves of the story. Now, when Joshua was near Jericho, so this is when they first came into the promised land across the Jordan River, as Joshua was a leader. He looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" "Neither," he replied, "but as commander of the army of the Lord, I've now come." Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" The commander of the Lord's army replied, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy." And Joshua did so. So you have this story where they're coming into the promised land before God has given any of it on the western side of the Jordan River to them. And you have an angel of God, a messenger from God, telling Joshua, this is holy ground. This is the promised land. This land has been set apart for your people, for you, so that you can fulfill the destiny. So the land was for the nation to be able to grow and be able to fulfill the destiny. To be at that crossroads, to be the main traffic area for all the people going from Egypt and the other nations back and forth, so that Israel could come in contact with them and bless them, be a blessing to others. Now, how were the Israelites to receive the promised land? We'll talk about this more in a few weeks, but let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 7. This is before they come into any of the promised land. And Moses is recounting here what God said, how this is going to happen. Chapter 7, verse 22. The Lord your God will drive out those nations before you, little by little. You won't be allowed to eliminate them all at once, or the wild animals will multiply around you. But the Lord your God will deliver them over to you, throwing them into great confusion until they're destroyed. He will give their kings into your hand, and you will wipe out their names from under heaven. No one will be able to stand up against you, and you will destroy them. So how would they get that land? God would give it to them. God would drive out the nations before them. Okay? That's what it says there in verse 22. God would drive them out. God was going to do this. Verse 16. You must destroy all the peoples that the Lord your God gives over to you. Do not look upon them with pity and do not serve their gods, for that will be a snare to you. So God would work through them, with them, to drive these people out, and they were to drive them all out. They were to destroy all the people in that land that God was giving to them. Otherwise, they would be a snare to them. They would be a temptation that would draw them away from God. So, all these ensuring factors here, we see that they're all tied, they're all attached to the manuscript. What is that reminding us? That reminds us that these ensuring factors were there to help ensure the destiny. All of these things were there to ensure the destiny. The divine intervention, the civil and moral law, the visual aids, the memorial feast, the tabernacle, the leaders that God chose, the promised land. All of that was there as ensuring factors to ensure that Israel could and would fulfill her destiny of being blessed to be a blessing and being the channel through whom God could bless all peoples. Now, an interesting question. How do these ensuring factors relate to us today? I'll let you think about that on your own. In fact, that's kind of the in-depth research question you see down at the bottom of the page here. What ensuring factors did God put in place with the early church, the New Testament Israel, to ensure that she could fulfill her destiny of being blessed to be a blessing? So, you know, think about that. What are the ensuring factors that God has in place for us today? Now, let's summarize. Let's look back at the picture here. You first see the manuscript and its message, and that reminds us that after Egypt, the destiny still stands. It wasn't something that God had given hundreds of years ago to Abraham and forgotten about. But the destiny is still there. God is still preparing them and ready to bring them into fulfilling the destiny. This manuscript is tied to this anchor. So that reminds us that the destiny is still there, but it needed to be ensured to make sure that it would be fulfilled. The anchor is lodged in the sand, reminds us that right now there was no solid ground of Israel being a solid nation under God that would ensure this destiny. So ensuring factors were critical at this infancy stage of Israel's history. And what were those? The lightning streaks on the left tell us that God divinely intervened. Divine interventions that God did developed confidence and trust to help ensure the destiny. The scales of justice remind us that the civil and the moral law that God gave prevented chaos and destruction of His people. The separated figures remind us that visual aids perpetuated the ideas of separation and obedience, and that helped ensure the destiny. The wine chalice and bread remind us that the memorial feast that God instituted would remind them on a regular basis of their past, their present, and their future. The tent refers to the tabernacle being a constant presence, a constant reminder of God's presence. That would help ensure the destiny. And then the mace, the leaders that God chose, that God provided, had the proper credentials of faithful relationships with God. And then the land scene, the land itself, the promised land, was to be conquered to be able to fulfill the destiny. All these rocks being attached to the manuscript remind us that these ensuring factors were all there for what sake? For what purpose? Not as an end in themselves. Okay? God did not do the divine intervention or give them the law or give them the visual aids of separation and obedience and all. Give them the memorial feast. Give them the tent of tabernacle. Give them the qualified leaders. Give them the land. That wasn't all given to them just to bless them, but it was given to them to ensure the destiny, to ensure that they would fulfill the destiny. Okay? These were ensuring factors. Let's pray. God our Father, you care so much for us. You care so much to bring us back to you that you went over and above, over and over and over and over again to help make sure that we didn't totally screw things up, that we didn't screw up your plan. And we know that there's nothing that we can do that can overpower your plan and keep your plan from happening. And we thank you for showing us that in the stories of the Israelites and seeing the ensuring factors that you put in place to ensure that they would be able to and would fulfill the destiny that you called them to. You've given us ensuring factors. You've given us a destiny. And you've put things in place to help ensure that we fulfill that destiny. Forgive us for the times that we stray from that, that we walk away from your calling. But keep calling us back and showing us that you've ensured us with the presence of your Holy Spirit to be a guarantee that we can fulfill your destiny. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.